Get snacking and get cracking with a snack that packs a protein punch. Pistachios are known for their protein power, fiber, and better-for-you unsaturated fats for a combination that may help you keep feeling fuller longer. Wonderful Pistachios is a good source of protein with zero guilt. Each one-ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. I love that they come in a variety of sizes and flavors, making this the perfect protein snack for any on-the-go adventure. Check out wonderfulpistachios.com to learn more about how these little green wonders can power up your day.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Flow Track Podcast. Happy Saturday. I'm Kevin. He's Gordon. FlowTrackPodcast at gmail.com is the email address. You can subscribe to the Flow Track Podcast YouTube channel where you can watch the show live and comment. You can also download the show anywhere you listen to audio podcasts. Gordon, the track events are done. It's a wrap.
We made it. You made it. I made it. Team USA made it. They ended it with two golds, which is what you like to see after what we saw the rest of the week. But hey, I'm thrilled for yet another great Olympics. I thought it was, there's a lot of good highlights and lowlights, which we'll get into throughout all of next week. But in the end, I'm kind of just like, you know, a little bittersweet, right? We've been waiting for this week for so long. It took 5 years instead of 4 years, and it's over. It's weird. It just, one thing that's weird about track meets is the final few days go so quick because there's all this like buildup of prelims, qualification, in, out, this, that, one-off events here and there, and then all of a sudden it's like we're just gonna do five events and it's over, and then everyone go home. So,
yep,
it kind of felt a little anticlimactic a bit, but there were some good moments today, especially with that women's 4x4, but. We'll dive all into it. What event do you want to talk about first? Well, I should tell people where I am.
Yeah, first, tell people where you are, and then I know right off the bat people want to know if you lost money or not throughout these last 9 days.
So,
I guess there's a marathon left, though, too. There's a marathon left,
yes.
Right? So, you could change your fortune.
I'm in a McDonald's parking lot. So, I got kicked out of the beach house, not because of my own doing, but because of the rules. So I don't have the Wi-Fi of the beach house, so I'm using the Wi-Fi of the McDonald's in the parking lot. We did this in 2020 when I went to the beach, so we're back doing it again. As for an update on my betting, so far I've betted a total of $4,400, right? That's how much money I gave to the casino, and I have won back $4,230. So I'm negative $170. That's how much money I have lost. So after doing $4,400 worth of bets, I lost $170, which isn't too bad. That's not too bad. Only losing $170, that's almost like breaking even. I do have one bet left, though. I have the Galen Rupp bet. He is plus 550. I have $100 on it. So if he medals, I then will I will win about $400, basically. What's 550 minus 170, I don't know. Quick math, right? I'll win about 300 some dollars. But if he loses, I lose another 100. So I'm either going to be down $270 or up about $300 to $400. That is the status after doing 44 bets with one bet to go. And I got screwed over so many times. I had Giannis better. Man, the guy's been throwing over 90 meters like 30 times, and he can't even make the final three throws. I had Grant Holloway winning. He didn't. I had so many people get fourth that I had meddling. So it's been a hard one for me. But lesson learned is, if you work hard at gambling, you can only lose $170. Come on, you gotta
admit, losing $170
is not that bad, right?
I just want to flash back to when you were up 900 and I said, walk away. This is a great lesson in why you shouldn't. You do all that work and the best you can hope for is to, I'm only losing $100, guys. This is great. Well, maybe Rupp can get some of that Molly Seidel magic in the marathon.
Exactly.
And get a medal to close it out for the USA. Because right now they sit on 26 medals. So I guess if the US gets a sweep in the marathon tonight, they could get up to 29. In track and field, but the floor here is 26 medals. Do you want to start with the 4x4s and then do the individual events? Does that sound good?
Yeah, let's start. All right. Start the highlights.
Highlights here,
America at least.
Yeah, let's go to the women's 4x4. So the question was answered first that we all wondered for the past month since the Olympic trials, really, who would be on the team? And I think things shook out the way you expected based on what happened in that open 400, when Allyson Felix gets the bronze, when Quinara Hayes doesn't break 50 seconds, looks like she's struggling a bit in the final, you figure they're going to run the big four, as we'll call them, McLaughlin, Felix, Muhammad, and Mo. That's precisely what they did. Sydney McLaughlin was a leadoff leg. She ran solid. Splits, I've seen a couple different splits, and I know the first leg is, and second leg are usually tricky to sort out because a lot of people have different in terms of where you take the split. But McLaughlin had them in the lead. Felix held them there. Muhammad blew it open basically with a 48.97, and then a thing Mo closed in a 48.3 for her split, which is one of the fastest splits in history. I saw a list from PJ Vizel's Twitter. It had her in the top 10 all time. They go 3:16.85, and that is the one of the fastest marks in history. 3:16.85. It slots in there at number five. Two American teams have run faster, but nobody's run faster than that since 1993. So this was a historically quick race, Gordon. And you had talked about the world record before. Hey, the competition is going to be versus the world record. It's not going to be versus anybody else, which ultimately ended up being true. I was a little bit more hesitant with the world record talk because I thought Doha 2019, there was a chance at the world record because you had two women smash 50 seconds in the open four, and then you came in with McLaughlin and Muhammad, and they weren't really that close. So that just made me respect that record even more. So 3:16 is a really solid performance for Team USA, and the margin, it was not close. Poland second in 3:20, Jamaica 3:21, which of course the great irony here is we debate and debate and debate about who's going to be on the team, and then ultimately it didn't matter. When you win by 4 seconds, they had a lot of margin for error.
Yeah, obviously it didn't matter. They're so deep that even if two of these four were on the team, they still would have won. I am so thrilled that a thing Mo, she had like one shot, right? This was her one shot to tell US Team USATF, mm-hmm. hey, I can be one of your 4x4 legs from now or till whenever I'm done, right? For the next 5 to 10 years. And yeah. If she would have gone out there and like kind of like ran like a 50.0 or 50 whatever, I think they would have been like, maybe we shouldn't be trusting these 800 meter runners to be legs on our 4x4s. But the fact that she goes out there, runs an all-time split, 48.3, just gets me excited because that means she's going to be like has a permanent spot on that 4x4 now. And mm-hmm. it's going to make her career that much more exciting because she's talked about wanting to do doubles, the 4.8 double. Mm-hmm. Now she could be in that weird realm where she can be collecting 800, 400, and 4x4 titles, and it'll just mm-hmm. be a unique array of opportunities for her instead of just being, because typically you're a distance runner, you just have your one event, and that's all you're in. Like, but she's going to be back and forth between the 4 and the 8. She's always going to have a spot on that 4x4. It's going to be exciting to see a thing Mo these next like 4 years, especially, you know, 22, 23, 24, 25. And I see how many medals she collects.
Yeah, and this was the perfect compilation of stars, because you had gold medalists in McLaughlin and Mo. You had silver medalist in Muhammad running as fast as she did in that final. And then, of course, you have the legend, Allyson Felix, who, you know, just broke that record for most medals by a woman in history and by an American now. So you had just all of the storylines converging on this one team, right? You had old and young. You had people coming from different events. It was just it's what you want to see in a 4x4, where it's just not 400-meter runner. Like, that's the beauty of a 4x4. Anybody who's run track, even at, like, the high school level, knows it's fun because it's an all-hands-on-deck type relay. You grab anybody from any event, whoever is the strongest at the end of the meet, and you put them out there and have them go. And you see here that the tweet from Nick Zicardi, most Olympic track and field medals. So Felix goes past Carlos. We talked about this yesterday, and you actually prompted me, Gordon, to do a very Gordon thing. I busted out a spreadsheet because you told me we were going to talk later about the GOAT in terms of not just the Olympics, but in terms of world championships. So I made this spreadsheet where I'm like breaking down Merlene Oddie, Veronica Campbell-Brown, Fraser Price, Felix. I got like a column for Elaine Thompson, hurrah, just to like project like what does she have to do. So this whole medal count thing has gotten my Google Sheets going here.
As much as I like Nick Zicardi, I really don't like these like total medal counts because it involves relays, and like it like removes someone like Brittany Reese, who can't be on a relay. Brittany Reese is getting has like 11 global medals when you include world outdoors and stuff like that.
Yeah.
With zero relay opportunities, right? So imagine if there's a long jump relay, maybe she'd add another 5, right? And she's up to 16. So, and then
imagine also, if there was a long jump thrower, relay.
It's against distance people, you know, so.
Yeah. Anyway. It's not an apples. Yeah. It's not apples to orange. And then when you bring in the relays, it's tough because your success is predicated on 3 other people. Others. Getting around. Yeah. But yeah, it shows the longevity of the sport. To me, again, I go back to what I said yesterday. The most impressive Felix stat for me is medaling in an individual event in 5 Olympics. That jumps out to me. Oh, you were top 3 in your event for what, 17 years it spanned now, because we had the extra year added on at the end. Let's go to the men's 4x4, where there was a little bit more of a question. Just because the men, these championships have had some underperformances. They've had some unlucky breaks. They've had a lot of silver. They did not have a gold on the track. And then the quartet of Cherry, Norman, Dedman, and Benjamin get it done here and get the win. Close going towards the latter stages of the race. I thought that Dedman put Bri Benjamin in a great position going into the anchor leg, and then he took it. From there, the U.S. ran 255.70. The Dutch, 257.18. Botswana, one of your picks, got the bronze medal there. But U.S., despite all the struggles, ends on a positive note. I think if they lost this one, then you'd been like, wait a minute, what is going on here? So you need to reevaluate everything here. Something, there was some bad luck. Someone opened an umbrella outside, did a black cat cross your path or something. But for the U.S., luckily, their talent shined through here, and they got the victory.
Yeah. This is what we expected, right? We talked 4x4s. You expect the U.S. to do what they're supposed to do. We didn't have a situation when we lost to Trinidad and Tobago, or obviously any, like, weird upsets. It's like, you're the best. You have the deepest team in the quarter mile. We are... eighth best 400 meter runner would be on every other country's 4x4, right? If you take the worst leg of our B squad, they would probably be on everyone's A squad. And if you have that depth, you need to be able to put together Olympic gold, and they did it. I think they probably also felt a little pressure, because I think they probably looked back in the team and they're like, man, like, we didn't win that mixed relay. Things are happening at 4x1. Let's end on a good note. And I think that was probably the mantra going into this race. It's like, we just don't overthink it. Just run to your ability and put together a good 4 legs. And they ran fast. They ran a good time. So it wasn't like a little like 257-y. Like, it was 255. So that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm curious to see the splits, and it'll be tough, just as it is with any 4x4, to the first and second legs in particular, sort those out because of how people take those splits. But I'd be curious to see Norman's leg there. Cherry did a good job. He closed really well. But it was close. It was close there. And Bryce Dedman, for his first time through, was real solid. He was a guy who ran well in Europe, so he hinted at how strong he'd be, and then he ran a solid leg in the prelim. I thought it was a great idea to close with Benjamin. He's just running with so much confidence right now. And you can see about 150 to go, he was thinking, man, there's no hurdles. This is amazing. I can just run. I don't need to jump over a single thing. And there's not the greatest 400-meter hurdler next to me right now trying to beat me. Like, this is great. This is a good deal. And I get a gold. Great way to end it for Ryan Benjamin.
I love this graphic that Travis has. Put that up on the screen. The U.S. currently has the 9 fastest times ever run ever. No one has ever broken it up. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of wild that USA's 9th worst time is better than the rest of the world. It's like a cool little streak. Eventually, a country's going to come in and run a 256 or a 255, kind of break up that top 9 mm-hmm. times. But until then, it looks kind of cool, right? You just see all America, and it's very consistent. Yeah. And that 254.29, we kind of felt like that might have been in the thoughts, because when Norman and Ryan Benjamin were in college, you're kind of thinking, mm-hmm. These two guys, they're going to be together. They're on the same timeline. We know Curly was doing well at that moment. It's like, yeah. They just got to find a fourth at the moment, and they could probably flirt with that 254. But now with Norman not 100% being the 43 mid guy that he is, it's a little, I'm not sure if this is the generation that gets it done. I mean, what do you think? Do you think this generation, by generation, I mean do you think a Ryan Benjamin, Michael Norman, 4x4, in the next 4 years, will run a 254.29 or faster?
It's a great question. I did see, did Fred Curley tweet out phase 43 the other day? Meaning, is that his hint? I take everything seriously now that Fred Curley tweets after the 100-meter silver medal. So if he's going back to the 400, yeah, maybe. Like, I didn't think this was the strongest the U.S. has looked in the quarter this year, and they run the fourth fastest time that they've ever run. I know it's a bit of a jump there down to number one all time. Yeah, phase 42, not even phase 43, excuse me, phase 42 with Curley. That was a couple days ago. So, yes, I think it's possible for them to break it in this era, because I think when you have that cornerstone of Benjamin, and he looks pretty solid in the years to come. And the U.S., look, here's the thing. The U.S. is just always going to crank out 44-second runners that can run 43s on relays. So you really just need to get, and I know it's tough, but you really need to have line up two of those transcendent stars who can split something ridiculous, and then put them together with your other two, and there you go. I just think when you look at that list, what it makes me think is, the calculus for U.S. 4x4 success is really easy, and I know this is oversimplifying it, because, yes, when you run fast, but run 255 and you get a gold medal. That's what it is. Run 255 and you get a gold medal. So figure out a team that can run 255, and no other country in history has run that. So they would have to run their national record and faster than any other team outside of the U.S. would have to run to get beat. So the times that the U.S. loses is when they're going outside of that 255 zone, which opens them up to an upset, but that was not the case today. Yeah, I am curious though to see these splits. Hopefully we get those pretty soon. I know I've been talking a bit about the 2015 World Championships, because when Lincoln was on the pod last night, we were in the marathon, he was at those championships, and that was a meet where the U.S. really did struggle. They only got 18 total medals and 6 golds, and they won the 4x4 at that meet. That was the only gold on the track, just like the only gold on the track for this competition, but the silvers and the bronzes weren't there as well. And I think the women in this competition did much better than they did in 2015. So looking at 26 total medals right now for the U.S. and those two 4x4 golds, Gordon, pushed the U.S. past Italy. They're in a tie with the Italians there.
Yeah. It's wild looking at some of the countries who are in that top tier, like Italy, having 5 golds. And only that's their only golds, right? Yeah, they're only gold. That's their only medals. Is that 5 golds, no silvers, no bronzes? And you know, it's always interesting. I think it's like Kenya, like it's wild what they do. They get 9 medals, but you know they're not only in like a third, like 25% of the events, right? They're only really focus on the 800 to the 10K to the marathon. So it's interesting to see what countries are able to show up and put together strong performances. But you know, it's a good sign when a disappointing year, you could say, is 26 medals, like for America. It shows the standard they're held to, that like, hey, you have 330 million people in your country. You have the NCAA system, like a really good breeder, situation to get the best athletes to the top. You should be able to be number one. I will wonder, when was the last time USA wasn't number one in a medal count at a track meet, at a global championship, Olympics or world? Do you know when the last time that was? Like how long it's been?
Are you just counting total medals?
Total medals, yeah.
That's a good question. I'm looking at the – I could go back on – I got the Olympics one open right here. You'd have to go – I mean, it might be – ooh, in 2000 it was close, 16-13 against Russia. But, yeah, I'd have to do some more. I'd have to do some more digging. Maybe someone in the chat. Maybe someone in the chat knows. Yeah, and listen, like the you look, I looked at the placing table too, so 1 through 8, and the U.S. is, you know, behind where they were too, which makes sense because if you have fewer gold medals, you're scoring fewer points, and everything gets pushed down a bit here too. But as we talked about before, a few things break this way, a few things break that way. It's just so close, you know, the margins are so small here between success, quote unquote, and failure, and Italy is a good example of that. As you mentioned, 5 medals and they're all gold. And then you look at a team like Great Britain, no gold. And it looked like, oh, they were so close. They ran great in the 4x1 for the men, just missed. Laura Muir, man, ran so great. But Faith Kipyegon was just a bit better. Josh Kerr ran the race of his life and just gets beaten, right? Like I felt like they were in a lot of things, but didn't get the gold. Australia felt like they were in a ton of things, mixing it up with a lot of finalists, and they didn't end up with any gold medals. It's pretty wild because so far 23 nations, I think they've updated this. Yeah, 23 nations have gotten a gold medal. And you'd look at the list of some of the countries that didn't get a gold medal and you'd probably be surprised who hasn't gotten a gold. If I told you 23 nations medaled, like you'd think Great Britain would be on that list, you'd think Australia would be on that list, Cuba with all their great jumpers, field event people, Czech Republic, Japan, France, Brazil, like none of them have golds. Spain doesn't have a gold. Ukraine with all their jumpers, right? And throwers. I don't know. Pretty crazy. Pretty crazy.
Ukraine doesn't have a gold because I bet on her to get gold and it didn't happen. So.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to the individual events here. Let's start with the women's 10,000, which came first this morning. Safwan Hassan caps off the Hassanathon with another gold medal. So her total number, 2 gold, 1 bronze, 24,500 meters. Geza Henge of Bahrain gets the silver. Letensipet Gidey, the world record holder, gets the bronze. Gidey tried to push this race, Gordon. She did what everybody thought she should do, including us. She tried to make it difficult for Hassan in the final 10,000 meters of this historic triple, but she couldn't shake her. She shaked everybody else. She shook off Helen Obiri, but she just could not get rid of Safwan Hassan. She ratcheted the pace down. They were running some 70s. The weather was tough. You could tell people were dropping out. It looked incredibly warm out there. So she wasn't running world record pace, but I think she was running about as quick as you could expect. And you could see a little bit over the last 4 laps, reality set in of, oh, I am not able to get rid of her. And then she put her took her foot off the gas a bit. I know there was a lap at 75 there towards the end where it seemed like she was saying, all right, well, now I'm going to just gear up for a kick. But at that point, you're not going to win a kicking contest with Safwan Hassan in this 10,000 if you're Lutensa Bekele. It doesn't matter how many races she's run before. At that point, it was written. Did it surprise you that Hassan was able to come back after the 1500 and still be so sharp at the back half of this race and stick with the tough pace?
Yes and no. The reason why I say no doesn't surprise me is she wouldn't have done it if she didn't think she was capable. She knew what her body was going to feel like going into a 10K after doing three rounds of 15s and two 5Ks. So she was mentally prepared for it. So it's not like last minute when the coach says you're running the 4x4 and then you're like, what? I thought I was done. And then you're like, you're not prepared and you might not handle that last race well. But she knew she was running this 10K for probably many months. And I think she trained for it. So I wasn't surprised that, like, she was either going to finish top three or be a DNF. Like, I don't see a situation where she runs for 10K and she's, like, running in the middle of the pack, finishing 9th, 10th, 11th. If she's going to be in it. She's going to be up there with the ability to kick, with to see, you know, kind of hoping that, you know, Gede doesn't have a once-in-a-lifetime race where she's able to, and that's what happened. Yeah. She didn't. She was able to outkick her and also the Bahrainian athlete. But I think the bigger thing that I want to take away from this triple as a whole is we've seen great, like, dominant distance athletes for many years, right? On the men's side, Bekele, Mo Farah, you know, everyone, right? We've seen a bunch of people who have been able to do a 5'10 double or they've just been able to dominate for a long time. Do you think what Hassan is doing will open the eyes of other athletes to be like, hey, maybe it's possible to do more doubles. It's possible to push yourself. Like, do you think this is a once in a lifetime type achievement that no one's ever going to, like, are we going to see more people attempt triples? That's what I'm going to ask. Because clearly Hassan has showed it's possible, right? Now, again, she is an all-time great athlete, but she did show it's possible. Will we see other athletes be like, hey, I'm going to try. I'm going to give myself three cracks at a medal instead of just going two cracks at a medal with the 5'10 or two cracks at a medal with the 5'15. You know, will we? I just want to know if you think this is going to change the way athletes approach a world championship with the mind of you're going fishing with a net where you just see how many medals you can catch as opposed to fishing with just one pole, your one event. Like the way Jacob Ingebrigtsen did. Jacob probably could have won that 5K, right? But he was like, no, I'm going all in on the 15, right? Just focus on the 15. Now it worked out, but maybe we see Jacob Ingebrigtsen be more into doing a 5:15 double because he's seeing an athlete like Safwan Hassan do this.
I think she's unique. So you mentioned all those people that have done doubles in the past and they were all-time greats. Hassan, obviously an all-time great, but Hassan's skill set is especially suited for this. And what I mean by that is not just she's really good in the 15, 5, and the 10. It's just her range in general. She's run 156 in an 800 and 65 and a half. So even before she was winning gold medals and even before she ascended to the top of the sport, like her calling card was her range. And some athletes just have better range. They're just able to, for whatever reason, some physiological feature that they have, they're able to adapt and be good at a bunch of different distances. Now, early on, she was good at a bunch of different distances, but she wasn't a gold medalist at all of them. Then she was able to apply that and pull this off. But no, I think she's unique. I think more people might get a bit more creative. But if you're asking who's going to be able to, you know, given the constraints of the schedule, if you're asking, are we going to see a 15-5-10 double? No, I don't think we're going to, or triple, excuse me. I'm so conditioned to say the word double. I don't think we're going to see, like, we don't even see that in sprint events. In the NCAA, we don't even see that. You see that in high school in the United States, and then it pretty much stops. But at that point, and I know every meet is different, and when you're trying to get team points, and then when you double, but there's very few instances of athletes running, competing in three running events throughout one competition. So I think what we're seeing here is something
relay
that,
related.
Yeah, exactly. Because even something like a 100, I mean, we saw, you know, we've seen obviously 100, 200 long jump, but you don't see 1, 2, 4 attempts. You don't see, you know, high hurdle. I mean, you've seen high hurdle, low hurdle before, but you haven't seen that third non relay event. And I know it's different in running events than it is in technical pursuits, just because you don't have as much time and energy to devote to the technical components of the sport. But I really think we're looking at something that we're going to be talking about in 20, 30 years as still holding up with Hassan.
Do you think Mo Farah in his prime could have done a triple? Because he was able to run some quick 1500s during that run. I think he had end up with a PB of like 3:28 or something like that.
Yeah.
Do you think there was any year where, like maybe in like 2012, do you think 2012 a triple was possible for Mo Farah?
That would have been the only, that range would have been his target, the 2012, 2013, 2015 spot, but... No, I really don't, because he ran the 3:28, but how would that have worked out through the rounds? Just the accumulation in her legs by the end of this competition. And listen, we talked about team tactics and how people never did it to Mo Farah. I think they would have absolutely done it in this situation where his last event was the 10,000 or his last event was the 5,000. It's harder to imagine it with Farah because while his wins were all spectacular, it was all like sit and kick. Usually,
yeah.
Safwan Hassan, like she in Doha, she was just taking command of those races when she did the 15, 10K double. She was just blowing people out, basically. She was in another area code. Farah's margins to the next best person was never as big. So I think he still could have gotten, he would have acquitted himself well. He wouldn't have embarrassed himself out there, but I think he probably would have won one gold, but I think he would have struggled in the 15. I think he would have put the other gold in jeopardy. So this is to go gold, bronze. I don't think we're gonna see it unless Hassan does it again in the near future.
Do you think if the 1500 for Safwan Hassan? Do you think if she did the 1500 and like she had if it was no overlap and the order went 15, 5K, 10K, where she got to do the 1500 completely fresh? Do you think there was any world where she would have won that 15 to get 3 golds instead of 2?
It's interesting you bring that up because one thing I liked about this result is that it left no debate about whether she should not have run the 15. Because if she got silver here, you'd say, oh, if she didn't run the 15, she could have run the 10K. Like the broadcasts were saying that. But you still managed, even though there's basically no questions left to be asked, to find a question to be asked, which was, how do you get her to 3 golds? I don't think so. I'm with you. I saw that Monaco race. It looked an awful lot like the race that we saw in Tokyo. Mir was really solid there for silver. I think Kip Yegon just is really good in these championship races. As we mentioned, I think she's the greatest female miler, 1500 meter runner of all time. So I don't think she did. I do like that Hassan did it though, because she needed to be challenged. If she had just run the 5 and the 10 and got 2 golds like she did, we wouldn't have seen her push to her absolute limit and see what she could get out of it. Like the double would have, and it's weird to say, but the double would have been too easy for her. So she needed to do this to test herself. And you're right that not all athletes, like you mentioned before, certain athletes, there's not a double available to them because of the event that they run. It's just not, it's not like the javelin throwers can't come back and do the shot. It's not practical. But she's lucky enough to be in an event grouping where this is at least a distinct possibility. Now, it's exceedingly rare for very good reasons. But it's fun to watch athletes have the ability to show fully what they're capable of. And when you see someone just win one title, you know, you see a thing Mo run that 155. Now she got to come back later in the 4x4, but you'd really want to see, okay, can we get a Thingmo in a quarter here? Like how good is she going to look in a 400? Like you want to see the people not just win by comfortable margins, but you want to see them, how do they respond when when they're pushed, when they're a little more tired, when things aren't going exactly perfect for them. And that's what this triple allowed us to see. It pulled everything that Hassan had out and showed us exactly what type of runner she is. And she's one of the greatest of all time. That's what it revealed. Like, this is, we're going to remember this forever, I think. Like what she did, the competition she beat too, I talked about that before. You know, she beat the 10,000 meter world record holder, left her in her dust today after running two events.
I got an idea for you, right?
Mm.
This is called the Safanathon, right? Hassanathon, whatever. Safan, Hassanathon. Mm-hmm. And it's the triple, but technically she didn't do it, right? It's not technically a triple because one of the races she got third. How about this? How about she changed the triple she goes for? Instead of trying to do the 15, 5, and 10, she should do the 10, the 5, and the 3K steeplechase. I think if you give Safan Hassan a year to learn how to get over barriers, I think she could pull off that type of triple, right? We know she can do a 5-10. I think seeing what she did in those 1,500-meter prelims and finals, I think that you could translate that into a fast 3K steeple, and I could see her pulling off an actual triple with three golds instead of just two and a bronze if she would learn how to steeple. I mean, you think you'd see more steeple and then another event doublers, right? Because I guess a lot of the steeplers stay. They like go into steeple and they stay, but you think there would be someone out there who's a dominant 5K runner or 1,500-meter runner who's like, hey, it's 3,000 meters. I can do that distance. It's got to learn how to get over the barriers. So maybe Safan Hassan can learn how to steeple. That's a triple I want.
Well, I saw some story. I forget where it came from, but that she was thinking with along with her coach that they might even try the 8-10,000 double at this meet. Which at that point, you're just trying to please like the content people at that point. Like, you're just, it's amazing. It's like, but it seems like a thing that you like debate with your friend. Like, you don't think it would actually be discussed. Like, hey, what's the widest range you can get between two different distances and still win gold? Like, hey, I'm at 8 and 10. That sounds cool. Like, but apparently they were actually considering it, which obviously would have been completely nuts to do. So I don't take anything off the table with Safan Hassan. Steeple, you risk the injury with the barrier, so that's a bit tough. But I don't think she'll go back down to the 8 now, because winning gold in the Thing Mo era seems foolish. But she's gonna come up with a new thing to challenge herself, and that's what's fun.
Marathon?
I did want to mention 5-10 marathon, maybe just do the Zatopek triple, because that her triple got compared to his because he went gold. But again, I'm not taking anything off the table anymore with Safan Hassan. So we should mention in fifth, Francine Niensaba. Speaking of 8-10K, former 800 meter star who was not permitted to compete in events from 400 meters through the mile and got DQ'd in that 5,000. She ends up getting fifth in the 10K, runs 30:41. So how about that? And then the Americans go 10th with Emily Sisson, 12th with Krisha Schweizer, and 13th with Alicia Monson.
I was surprised to see Niensaba do that well. I mean, she ran it, and it's a quick time, 30:41. Think about this. She wasn't thinking 10K until for like only, she was, imagine like telling, you know, Trayvon Bromell, hey, you have 2 years to run a 1:44.800. He's like, are you kidding me? I'm not going to be able to run one. Yeah, I'm an elite athlete and all, but I'm not going to run a 1:44.800. That's basically what Niensaba is doing. After being an 800 meter runner, she's like, oh, go run a 30:41 10K. This is, it's wild. I was impressed to see her finish there in the top five.
Well, this proves our theory. It's a good thing they went out fast, because she definitely could hang with that pace. If it got tactical, that would have been crazy. So if Gede didn't push the pace and it lagged because of the heat, then she'd have been right there. All right, let's go to the 1500, men's 1500 here. Jacob Ingebrigtsen, you called it, Gordon. You said going back several months now, maybe even last year, you said J- Jacob could beat Timothy Chariot. He does it. He's now 1-13 all time against Chariot. This is his first victory. Ingebrigtsen went to the front early on, got the pace going. They went through at 56, but then Chariot hopped right to the front of the train as expected. This was quick. They go through 800 in 151. A lot of other people are going up there to join Chariot, but he's still pushing the pace with some quick laps. 247 through 1200. Josh Kerr puts his name into the hat there. But Ingebrigtsen was latched on. He's latched on the entire way. And with 100 to go, he makes his move, runs a 3:28 to get gold ahead of Chariot. This race was fast from top to bottom. Everybody but Chariot in the top six got a PB. So the fastest race of Ingebrigtsen's life. And Josh Kerr almost gets past Chariot to get the bronze medal. The podium, not wholly that surprising when you look at how fast people have run this whole year and the type of race we expected. But still, when you're 0-13 against somebody going into an Olympic final and you get the upset, it's at least a little bit shocking, because we just have not been used to Chariot losing big races over the past couple of years.
I just feel like Jacob Ingebrigtsen was, I'm trying to come up with an example. He was like a fire hose that was just spraying at like a crack in the wall, right? And that crack was holding the water in for as long as possible. This fire hose was him coming on the scene at age 18 and 17, running fast at all-time age marks, making finals, doing well at Euros, and like then challenging the best at Monaco Diamond Leagues, finishing third in a bunch of races. And he constantly was throwing more and more pressure on the elites of the elites at this event. And finally, the dam broke. And I think now that the dam has broken, that he is able to become victorious in the ultimate event, which is the 1500-meter final at the Olympic Games, it's just going to, like, I don't see anyone beating this guy for at least, I think he can go on a run. I think he's been waiting to break through. He finally has it. Chariot cracked. And now it's going to be smooth sailing from here, because, like, he's only 20 years old, right? He's not even 21. Is he 21 or is
Correct.
He 20? 20 years 20. Old. He's shown that he's able. He's now gone through the gauntlet of, you know, failures and successes, big PBs, big breakthroughs. The sky's the limit now for him. And I think he's going to go on a big run for these next 2 to 3 years of continuing being the gold medal favorite and most likely always achieving that gold medal, because I don't see Chariot coming back to being able to, like, in 2022, I would give Ingebrigtsen 75% chance of winning.
All right, let's calm down a little bit. This is first win. It's first win. Well, there's other guys there too. This was a deep race. I agree.
He looked like he was jogging across that finish line.
I don't know about that.
He wasn't.
I don't know about that. I think tactically, what Chariot did makes sense. And keep in mind, he's only 25 as well too. I think tactically what Chariot was, it was consistent with what he's done. But I wonder, basically, Jacob played this perfectly because he went out, got the pace going. So it was going to be honest, which is what you want to do if you've run sub 1250 for a 5K and you're really good in Diamond Leagues. But then Chariot he insists on leading. So then Chariot's doing all the work and Ingebrigtsen's just sitting on his shoulder until 100 meters to go. I think Chariot's strategy would have worked a little bit better in the 2019 era when there was more of a gap. But now we have the situation where everybody's so much closer. So those minor things start to play in. I'm seeing this tweet here from Cathal Dennehy. Timothy Chariot confirms his coach spoke to Jacob Ingebrigtsen's coach/dad ahead of the final and plan was made to cooperate to share the pace in the 1500-meter final. Chariot said he felt his left hamstring ever since the semifinals and during the race. Okay, so they made a plan, which was good. Would you call that sharing the pace, though? Hey, you do the first 400, And then I'll do everything up until the final 100. You do 0 to 400, and then I'll do 500 to 1400. Because me was, I guess he, let's see, Jake, yeah, Jake, second. I mean, he's right there. He wasn't far off the pace, but Cherry there was doing the lion's share of the work.
I don't blame
Ingebrigtsen for doing it, but I don't, sharing is tough to do in a 1500. It's not a 5K where you have enough time to settle in. I guess sharing means the first lap.
I think that conversation was, hey, if we make this a sub 330 race, we're guaranteed 1-2. Or we're both, not, well, maybe not 1-2, but we're both guaranteed medals. If we let someone else take over and this becomes, you know, a Sensewitz type race in 2016 where the winning time's like 340 or 335, they might not guarantee 1-2. So I think they were like, hey, you and me, we know we're better than everyone. If we make it sub 330, our odds go drastically up, and then let the best man win. So let's make this a dual meet and not a 12 athlete final. That's what I think.
Well, it almost didn't work because Kerr almost got Chariot there at the end. So it almost was gold and bronze. Okay, well, if that's the thinking, makes a tad more sense, I believe. I mean, I think you're right. I think overall, yes, it makes sense. I just don't know, did they draw straws for who was going to do the first lap and who was going to do everything else? Because Chariot, he does seem more comfortable in front, just like the way his stride is and what he's used to running. Like, he does seem more comfortable in front. So I would get, maybe he would say, hey, it's fine. I would rather be in that position. But when you look at how that race played out, and Jacob was super duper strong over the last 100, you'd think, okay, the better chance would have been, or a different chance, and maybe it would have given you only a tiny bit better shot at winning. And you see this in hindsight, so obviously it's impossible to predict, but if he didn't have to put as much pressure, because they went 56 for the open, then Chariot took over and dropped a 54, and then it went to about a 56 again. So he was not lagging in those laps. It wasn't as if he took over and then slowed the thing down. It's funny, we get team tactics and then they're between Norway and Kenya. And then in the high jump, they're between Qatar and Italy. Those are the two greatest moments of teamwork, I think, these entire Olympics.
Hey, maybe it was the pandemic. Everyone was sick of being all by themselves. It's just the way they come together. Cross-country, generational coming together, young and old, you know, East Coast, West Coast. That's what we're seeing. We got to talk a little bit about Josh Kerr. Dude.
Yeah.
Sixth in 2019. He was kind of had, you know, you were wondering if he was going to be a consistently, like, hey, he's always going to be able to make a final, but I don't know if he's ever really going to be top three caliber, right? He can, you know, always maybe one time get fourth, but he's going to be fourth to 10th, you know, notoriously, and always have, like, a solid PB. But this was him saying, like, no, I'm not going to be complacent with just being a good top 12 type guy in the world. I want to be able to start putting my name on the record books, have like a Nick Willis type career where you can look back and say, I have multiple medals. And I think this is a very impressive medal that he got, because it was a fast race. There was no like fluky tacticals that got him to third. And he almost caught Terry, which you mentioned, but I was very impressed with the massive PB. He timed his season perfectly. I remember watching, he did a time trial. Where he negative split like a one, I wish I could remember the time he ran, but he negative split like a 150, which I thought was interesting to kind of practice how to like close hard off of a hard pace. And look at the progression here on the screen. We'll put that up. I remember when he broke that collegiate 1500 meter record in Azusa, he's in 335.01 there in 2018. And then just 3 years later, he's already running sub 330. And getting Olympic medals out of it. Very impressive for Josh Kerr. It's always cool to see an NCAA athlete like find a way to keep that success moving into the next level at the Olympic level, because a lot of times dominant NCAA milers or NCAA distance runners in general, they kind of just plateau out, right? You kind of realize they're only as good as their surroundings. But Josh Kerr being able to go to that next step, which is the hardest step to take. It's easy to go from high school to college because the training just is so much better. But to go from college to Olympic medalist is just like, it takes more than just good coaching. It takes like unique talent. And so Josh Kerr to quickly go into the top three, very impressive. And I'm a big fan of Josh Kerr.
And you had a situation where in Doha, he didn't get a medal, but he ran his best race there, I thought. He ran fast time. He's a big race runner, Josh Kerr. And he's one of those guys we've been watching the last couple of years. He's not afraid to push the pace. So he knew that this was the type of race that was going to play out in Tokyo, and he was completely prepared for it. And we've just had such a huge change in the 1500 over the last couple of years, where you had everything was, he was predictably slow and tactical, and then now we're going to the just basically from the gun. It's to the point they don't even need, they don't need rabbits. It, like, you could have a situation where like the world record is under threat in a race, as long as the track is fast and the conditions are good. But just with all these guys, like, you put Stuart McSwain in a race, he's going to go hard. You put Timothy Chariot in a race, he's going to go hard. Kurt is going to go hard. Ingebrigtsen is going to stick right there, and he's not afraid to lead. Nobody is afraid to lead in that top tier of milers right now in the world, and this is the result. And I think Chariot kind of started that, where he just was like, hey, I'm better than everybody, so I'm not going to play any games. I'm going to make this a 1500. I'm not going to make it an 800 or 1000 or a 400. I'm just going to run an 800. And everybody's followed his lead, because that's what you've needed to do to catch up. I remember in Doha, in the post-race, people were basically saying, yeah, we knew we were running for second. And that wasn't the mentality here. The mentality was, Chariot set the standard. Now we need to follow. And Ingebrigtsen was in that 15 in Doha. Granted, he had run the 5 already as well, too. So he knew that. Josh Kerr was in that race. He knew exactly what to expect. And yeah, what a big time performance there. Great Britain gets 3 into the final and comes away with a medal there. Farther down in the list, I'll just...
Well, before you get to that, Travis, can you put back up that Cathal quote of the Rule 40? So Cathal tweeted out, Josh Kerr was asked about his sponsor, Brooks, and due to Rule 40, he's not allowed to say anything. So he says, am I allowed to mention these guys? He's told no. And then he says, the brand that you just said is bloody awesome. They believed in me when I was in the NCAA. I'm very proud of my decision to go with them. And that goes like, hey, man, Danny Mackey just coached an Olympic bronze medalist in the 1500. That Brooks, you know, some people, you know, we kind of think about, like, where do you go for training? Like, everyone wants to go to the Bowerman Track Club, right? Or NOP during their time when they were up. And Brooks Beast maybe wasn't considered, like, the number one choice for everyone. But now Danny Mackey can sit back and be like, hey, guys, if you have the talent and you work hard, I can coach you to run sub 330 and be an Olympic bronze medalist. I'm just so thrilled for Danny Mackey. It's wild. But big up to the Brooks Beasts getting it done. I'm excited to see what they can do. I mean, they also have some other guys, like Henry Nguyen was running pretty well this season for the U.S. Obviously, it's hard to make that U.S. team. But maybe there's a college kid out there who's now thinking, hey, maybe Brooks Beasts is my path, because clearly it works for some people.
Yeah, his success as a pro was not guaranteed. Yeah, he was an NCAA champion and he broke the collegiate record and he ran 335. But we've seen people who have won titles and not necessarily run as fast as he did, because he ran 335, but who have had really good college careers and it doesn't translate in the mile. Like, that's happened often. And for him, and then you saw Oliver Hoare in this final, he mixed it up too. He really put himself out there, ended up fading a bit too. For them to translate and be big time pro runners is something you can't take for granted. On that Rule 40 thing, I'm wondering, like, what's the most creative way, if you can't say the name, can you get the reporters to say the name back to you and be like, oh, that's awesome? Like, if you said, hey, who's an underrated character in Shawshank Redemption? And they say, oh, Brooks. And you'd be like, yeah, that was my favorite character. That character really helped me prepare for today. I just can't tell you how much that character was better than all the other characters. I'm wondering if there's a way to get, I mean, he played that pretty well though, because he knew the rule, didn't want to violate the rule, but then he said it without saying their name. That was pretty well done there by Kerr. Tactically sound on the track and with interviews, Josh Kerr.
There you go. And then he mentioned, obviously, there was one athlete in this field that we were kind of all interested to see how he would perform. Cole Hawker making his first final still in college at University of Oregon. Had to set a PB just to qualify for the final. Sets a new PB, runs 3:31:40, which, you know, in any other year, that was the older Olympic record. Obviously, everyone broke the Olympic record this year because it was just a fast race. But 3:31, that kind of reminds me of like what Andrew Weeding did. Remember when he had this wild 1500-meter PB in Monaco? To do this in a championship final, I feel like has a lot more cachet to it because it wasn't like a perfect time trial type race. It's like, hey, we're trying to medal. I'm excited for what Cole Hawker's going to do next. This is a good result for him. He didn't blow up and, like, you know, finish, like, dead last. He put himself in it. He didn't let the fast pace affect his performance. He now goes into next year with a 3:31 PB, with experience of going through multiple rounds from NCAAs to trials to Olympics. He's going to be very hard to beat in 2022, especially on the U.S. circuit, after having all of this experience, all the way ending up with a sixth place finish at the Olympics. I mean, Josh Kerr, he was sixth in 2019. And then 2 years later, he's a bronze medalist. Cole Hawker, maybe he's the next guy to go from sixth to, you know, a medalist.
To the podium, yeah. If you look at that race, he started in the back, which is not unusual for him. And then when it really broke up towards the middle, and listen, you go 56, 54, it's just tough to keep up. And you're wondering, man, is he going to run the kick? Is Hawker going to be able to close? Now, he wasn't with that lead pack, and all the focus was on what Ingebrigtsen was doing. But he closed well. He was in ninth at the first 100, but then he was in – these are the 100-meter segments for him. 12th, 11th, 12th, 12th, 11th, 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 10th, 10th, 9th, 9th, 7th, and then 7th, and then 6th. So. On that last lap, he was in like ninth or 10th place in that back half of the race and still was able to get sixth and goes 3:31. Any chance that he stays in college?
I mean, he shouldn't, but he can if he wants. So my saying he shouldn't should not have any impact on his decision because he should do what he wants to do. If he wants to live the college life one more year, go for it. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing like, the money's going to be there whether he leaves now or later. I highly doubt the contract that he signs in June of 2022 would be any different than the contract he signs now. I don't think anything could happen. Like, even if he were to get hurt in 2022, in indoor or something like that, I don't think any sponsor's going to be like, oh, yeah, his career is over. A 20-year-old is hurt. Like, come on. Mm-hmm. Like, it's going to be fine no matter what. I think his thing he's probably thinking about is like, hey, cross country, that's a fun, like, team element. Super tier potentially can come back as well. They do have a good transfer in Aaron Benfeld from Cincinnati. So they have a good big three. You throw in some of the other guys who maybe like Jackson Messler might come back or something like that. They could find a way to get a good solid group of five guys that could compete for a national team title, which I think is really the only reason he would want to come back. Because other than that, like, hey man, like you got a great like college career ahead of you. I'm not college, great, a pro career ahead of you. Whenever you want to start focus on that, go for it. So. I think he will go pro, and I think college cross country isn't worth it, man. Just take the extra 8 months of cash. Like, who cares?
Well,
your per diem in cross is going to be like $50 a day. Your per diem when you have a contract for an extra 8 months, it's going to be a lot more than $50 a day.
If there's one thing we'd learn from these championships is that no success is guaranteed too. We've seen a lot of people, young people, who look like their career was going to be gold, gold, gold. And then now they're in their mid-20s and they haven't been able to replicate their performance. So yeah, you want to strike while it's hot. One thing that would change would be just the amount of races he would run. Who made this graph? Is this Travis? Did you make this graphic? Or is this Gordon? This isn't Gordon's font. So I don't think this is a Gordon spreadsheet here. But I guess we can throw that up there. Ingebrigtsen ran 11 races this year. Chariot ran 7. Kerr ran 9. Hawker ran 27 races. So basically, he ran as about he ran the same amount of races as the other three combined when you add up the podium. Ingebrigtsen, Chariot, and Kerr. Hawker ran 19 outdoors, and he ran 8 indoor races. 12 outdoor 1500s. You add up all those rounds and that makes sense. So, but hey, some people that works well for them. And then you get to the pros and you don't race as much and you stagnate a bit. I'll be interested to see where he goes. I would guess he would stick with the same coach, but who knows? Who knows? But he's clearly at the level now where there's absolutely no question. All right.
Yeah. And obviously, there is name, image, likeness, right? So he could make money in, like, other ways. But I think there's also the factor, like, do you want to, like, go to school and, like, go to class and have to deal with that and making sure you're academically eligible, blah, 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 blah. Like, I guess you may want to still stay in school because you want to have a degree. I mean, he still has two more years. But I think it's going to be, hey, do you want – he can make money either way. He probably can make more money signing a legitimate actual Nike contract or Adidas contract or whatever contract versus making money off your Instagram and t-shirt sales and this, that, and the other thing. So he has a way to still make money off of his likeness, but is this going to be like a, I think it's going to be like a Tim Tebow situation, right? Tim Tebow could have gone pro, but he loved playing at University of Florida so much. It's like, no, I'm coming back one more year, even though I'm a first-round draft pick. Screw it. Let's go. I think he's going to basically weigh, like, the love of running for Oregon versus the next step of his inevitable career, which would be being a professional athlete.
Well, this will be a true test in the track and field world of NIL because you have Hawker, who already had – pretty good name recognition within the track and field community, take a huge step up after the college season, winning trials and then performing as well as he did in the 1500s. So you have to see, you have to think, oh, his stock is pretty high right now, higher than virtually any other athlete who hasn't already been signed. So which route does he go? What sort of things does he consider when he's making this determination? Is it the freedom to choose your schedule? Yeah. How much can you make in NIL versus how much can you make with a straight, just quote unquote, traditional shoe contract? Because he's probably the most, he would command the most money, you think, at least on the men's side of anybody out there right now. And this is the first year, this is the first off season where we've had NIL in place to make that determination. But here's what he has to consider from a competitive standpoint. Yeah, he's only 20. Do you know who's only about 260 days older than him?
Jacob Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah. And I know Ingebrigtsen's clock probably started sooner because he's been running at such a high level for so long, but the rest of the world doesn't wait for you. And you go from being the younger guy to being, okay, now I'm at the peak, now I need to be turning out these medals, to, hey, there's like three people who are running faster than me who are younger, like pretty quick. That comes at you very quickly. And even, we talked about this in the 5,000 with Grant Fisher, and then you're like, okay, wait, how old is Joshua Cheptegei? How old is Jacob Kiplimo? And it's not like there's not going to be a new 21-year-old from one of these countries that's going to pop up. So can't take any success for granted, can't take any medal for granted. So, I'll be interested to see how Hawker positions himself the next couple of years. Field event time. We'll start with devastation for you, Gordon, in the javelin. Johannes Vetter, who I called, I looked it up, what I said in the preview, which is why you should laugh whenever I say anything like this. I called him the lock of all locks. Now, I still would have taken Krauser over him, but I literally wrote down lock of all locks because he was over 90 so many times. He comes out with a series of 82-52, then foul. So he doesn't get his last three throws, misses that by less than a meter. Meanwhile, Neeraj Chopra in the second round throws 87-58. That throw holds ahead of Vajacek and Vesely of the Czech Republic. So Chopra wins the first ever gold for India in a track event and first track medal since 1900. Looked like a typo, but I saw it out there. Wow. In a couple spots. First track medal since 1900 and the first gold. Here we go. Let's put it up. The Olympics account tweeted it. First Indian to win an athletics medal and only the second to win an individual medal. So in track and field, never been done before for gold.
You think India would, it's such a large country, right, population-wise, that they would be able to find a way to have a better way of developing their athletes. I guess they don't focus on, I mean, they're probably really good in cricket, right? They're probably good in other events that, you know, maybe some other countries, you know, put more focus in. But it was pretty cool seeing him win. Even if I'm going to lose, I lost $200 on that bet. I would have won $340 because it was a parlay. I'm so upset. I was like, come on. Vetter and Grant Holloway made me lose out on $700 of winnings. It's just like, come on. Anyway, I would be positive. If those two hit, I would be positive right now. That's all I'm saying. I would be positive if Grant Holloway and Jan has a better one. Anyway, but regardless, back to Chopra. I was impressed. It's pretty cool to see, you know, a guy who everyone was overthinking. And think about, like, what your mindset is when you're going into the final three throws in the lead and you know Johannes Vetter isn't left to throw three more times. You're probably freaking out. You're like, holy crap. That's the one event everyone thought they were fighting for second. And then all of a sudden, you're in the lead with three throws remaining, and you know there's a legitimate chance you might actually win gold. So that was probably a wild final three throws for him. And his second throw held up as the ultimate best mark. So it's pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is a weird thing with the throws and the horizontal jumps. You're just waiting. Like, you could put a big one out there and you're thinking, I could win gold if everybody else just sucks the rest of the way. I may not need to do anything better than what I just did now, or someone could match me and now I have to go better than I've ever done before too. It's got to be a weird mental state. And they always support each other too in the field events. They're always over there, you know, rhythmically clapping in the jumps and dapping people up and stuff. I'm sure there's exceptions out there, but your fate is so tied to them and you have time. It's not like a 1500 where you're like watching someone go by and you're comparing times or something like that. So you're in the race with them, so you don't have time to think about that. You're sitting there on the long jump runway or watching the jav competition. You're just like, hey, how about you throw a 70 meter throw this time, because then I could win gold. But yeah, congrats to Neeraj Chopra making history for India. High jump. We had a pretty fun back and forth competition there in the women's high jump. Ultimately, Maria Lasaskine, who went on that crazy win streak a couple of years ago, but wasn't the clear cut favorite going into this year's championship, she goes over at 204, which was the winning height ahead of Nicola McDermott of Australia, and then Yaroslav Mahuchik of Ukraine gets bronze ahead of her teammate Gerashenko. Eleanor Patterson of Australia gets fifth, and then Vashti Cunningham of the U.S. finishes in sixth. I thought she had a podium chance here, but Gordon, it's Lassa Skine and the Russian Olympic Committee getting the gold medal.
It's wild. Look at these results. Lassa Skine, she won at 204, but that jump at 196, she made on her third attempt. If she doesn't hit that third attempt, she finishes 10th in this competition. So she went from one jump away, one miss away from being 10th, to then, you know, going back on a run and being able to ultimately clear 204. It's wild. It took her three attempts at 196, but only two attempts at 204.
Yeah. Reminds me of women's pole vault with Najat almost missed at the opening height and then gets the gold medal. Maybe there's something to it. You start to appreciate the other jumps more. And yeah, Mahuchik almost went out at 198, which, I mean, Cunningham didn't clear that, so that wouldn't have helped her. But yeah, it always seems like two meters, you're in business here. Anything less than 2 meters, it's going to get a bit tricky. Interesting to see just the geographic distribution here. Four of the top five in the women's high jump is Ukraine and Australia. It's just like, how did that happen? That's just a weird thing. Like two high jump focused countries.
Track is weird, man. Track is weird.
That is one thing we've learned. Anything else you want to touch on before we go? Because I got to get prepped and ready for the marathon show tonight because Lincoln and I are running it back with the men's marathon.
I'm just hoping that you give a good luck charm to Galen Rupp on the broadcast. Because if he wins, I win. And America wins and we all win. And everything is great. So that's all that matters. So.
All right. Yeah, we got these splits. We can put these splits up before we go. Here's the 4x4 splits. Cherry 44.2, Norman 44.0, Deadman 44.01, and then Rye Benjamin 43.40. Did anybody else split anything like a 43.40? So you have Terrence Agard of Netherlands, 43.7 on the second leg. Makwalas is 43.8. See, I thought Cherry handed off before him, though. Didn't it look like Cherry handed off in the lead? You got a 43.6 here for Zalewski.
It's weird.
Nobody's anchor leg was close to Rye Benjamin. Yeah, you could tell. Yeah. Nobody's anchor leg was close to Rye Benjamin. There's a lot of people running really fast on that second leg there. But you look at all these. Nobody anchored sub 44. Am I right?
Yeah, no one anchored sub 44. It was all Benjamin.
Yeah, which makes sense. So you look at this, though, and you think, okay, maybe that world record is possible because you have three and they're all 44 lows, but it's not impossible to imagine another sub 44 Norman. Now that was on an anchor leg, right? The famous 43.0 split that he did in Sacramento, a little bit different set of circumstances here, but you get two 43 mid to lows on a team. And like I said, you're in business. All right. Gordon's like pulling out of the McDonald's parking lot. We got to go. That's it for today's show. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. No, Gordon's starting the car. That means it's time to go. We got one more live show tonight, 5 p.m. Central Time, men's marathon. Whoa, that's loud. Thanks to Alon for producing. Thanks to Travis for producing. Gordon, good luck with your marathon picks. I'll talk to you on Monday. See everybody else tonight.